Welcome to the Mysterious Old Radio Listening Society, a podcast dedicated to suspense, crime, and horror stories from the golden age of radio. I'm Eric.
I'm Tim.
And I'm Joshua.
We love mysterious old-time radio stories, but do they stand the test of time? That's what we're here to find out.
Today, I chose an episode of Crime Classics entitled Death of a Picture Hanger.
Crime Classics debuted on CBS Radio June 15, 1953. As the title suggests, it was an anthology series featuring dramatizations of true crime stories, ranging from truly classic cases like Jack the Ripper and the assassination of Abraham Lincoln to lesser-known crimes such as Bathsheba Spooner, the first woman in the United States to be tried and executed for murder.
The program was created, produced, and directed by the prolific and multi-talented Elliot Lewis. Scripts were by Morton S. Fine and David Friedkin, who, at the same time, were collaborating with Lewis on another radio series, Broadway Is My Beat. Not to be outdone, Lewis was simultaneously directing, producing, and starring in a third series for CBS, On Stage with Kathy and Elliot Lewis. In fact, during the fall of 1953, Crime Classics and On Stage were broadcast back-to-back.
Lewis, Fine, and Friedkin approached the program's dark subject matter with an equally dark sense of humor. The droll tone was personified by the host and narrator, fictitious connoisseur of crime, Thomas Highland. Veteran radio actor Lou Merrill played Highland with a wry smile in his voice and an audibly arched eyebrow. The titles, like the scripts, drip with irony and understatement. Blackbeard's 14th Wife, Why She Was Not Good for Him, The Hangman and William Palmer, Who Won, and my personal favorite, The Axe and the Droot Family, How They Fared.
And now, let's listen to Death of a Picture Hanger from Crime Classics, first broadcast July 20th, 1953.
It's late at night and a chill has set in. You're alone, and the only light you see is coming from an antique radio. Listen to the sound coming from the speaker. Listen to the music, and listen to the voices.
Good evening. This is Crime Classics. I am Thomas Highland. I'm going to tell you another true crime story. Listen. The man is nailing a horse's picture to the wall. The horse is pawing the western skies in the classic attitude of pawing horses, and it is the top half of a calendar distributed by Isaac's Livery. It's a hot April day in St. Joseph, Missouri, in the year 1882, and the man is hanging the picture in his living room because he has a fondness for the noble beast. Horses have gotten him out of many a critical situation, such as 1, holding up railroads, 2, robbing banks, 3, murdering fellows. His name is Jesse James, and as soon as he finishes hanging that picture, a friend of his is going to shoot the back of his head off. So tonight, my transcribed report to you on the death of a picture hanger.
Crime Classics, a new series of true crime stories taken from the records and newspapers of every land, from every time. Your host each week, Mr. Thomas Highland, connoisseur of crime, student of violence, and teller of murders. Now, once again, Thomas Highland.
Tonight, we take you to Jefferson City, Missouri, to the mansion of the governor of that state. His name was Crittenden, but his cronies called him Critch. He liked living in the governor's mansion because he never had it so good. There were servants, crystal chandeliers, wine furnished by cronies, entertainments by cronies, and best of all, 6 small gilded cherubs, backs bent cheerfully to support a cast-iron bathtub, and quite often the governor also. So, if you've never attended the governor taking a bath, here's your chance.
Where's that soap? Where is it?
Well, there it is, Critch. Right behind you.
sheriff.
Uh-huh.
When's the last time you had a bath?
Kansas City, just after the hanging of Billy Bob Williams. Let's see, that was,
March 12th, last.
What a memory you got, Governor.
Yeah, hanging outlaw is one of the nicest parts of this job, Timberlake. You ever get to be governor, hang a lot of outlaws and remember when. That way you can tell people and people will be impressed and keep you governor.
I'll remember.
Hand me that rose water and glycerin, Sheriff.
Oh, sure. Oh,
thanks. You know what I called you down here for?
Got an idea.
Tell me and I'll tell you if you're right.
Jesse James?
Look good on my record. He to die somehow soon. During my administration in my state.
People will cheer you wherever you go.
I like the sound of people cheering.
Governor.
Hand me the towel, Sheriff.
Oh.
Thanks.
Governor, I've been thinking.
Scheming kind of thinking?
Well, you might say.
About Jesse?
If it works, people liable to cheer you right on to Washington. Then there's no telling what.
In a case like that, you're liable to be standing right where I'm standing.
That's right.
Get Jesse for me.
I'm gonna do that.
Not since Kansas City, huh, Sheriff?
Not since then.
Well, how'd you like to take a bath right now?
I didn't want to say nothing. I was hoping you'd ask.
She's all yours, Sheriff. Enjoy yourself.
Sheriff Timberlake was a man who instinctively knew his way around a bathtub. He soaked, lathered, and rinsed and was out of there in the shake of a lamb's tail. Then he went home. Then he changed his clothes. He got into a nondescript outfit of brown woolen pants and a black alpaca coat. And he went down to Kansas City. Many things were to be found in Kansas City. A wooden monument, long since burned, of Daniel Sanker, who got a message through to his beleaguered dad, a grand opera house, and three mechanical pianos, each with fiddle attached. All in all, it was a very happy community. Worthy of note is the fact that Spit in the Ocean, a poker variation, was invented at Bobrick's Poker Palace during this era. And it is into this very den that Sheriff Timberlake wandered. He wandered here because he was looking for someone. A girl. A young lady whose job it was to stand in back of strangers at the gaming tables and make signals to the houseman on the opposite side. When Timberlake approached her, she had three fingers in the air and the tip of her tongue pointing to the left.
Maddie.
Oh.
Up you, Hunter.
Want to talk with you, Maddie.
A second.
Raise you.
Carl.
I got me a one-eyed jack in the hole. Gives me three of them. Where'd you say you're from?
Roanoke. Nice place.
Come on. Out here. What you want?
How's Johnny?
You said you weren't going to turn him in.
For favors.
What you want him to do?
Nothing.
What you want?
Jesse James.
Oh.
Got to clean up Missouri, Maddie.
Oh?
Got to start with Jesse.
If you say it.
Yeah, Jesse's staying with Robert and Charlie Ford.
That's right.
Now, your friends, ain't they, Maddie, Robert and Charlie Ford?
I used to know them pretty good.
Ain't hard to talk to old friends, Maddie.
And you ain't gonna touch Johnny, are you?
You just tell Robert and Charlie Ford I'm at Stamponi's boarding house right now. Ain't got a gun, either.
That all you want me to do?
You tell them, Maddie. You hear? is it?
The fourth.
Door's open. Come on in, boys. Well, didn't Matty tell you I left my guns back in Jefferson City? Just you come on in.
Bob, over there.
All right.
Glad to see you back in Missouri, Charlie. Heard you and Robert were over in Kansas for a while. Heard you're in jail. Heard you killed a man to get out. Glad to see you back in Missouri.
Bob, get him.
All right.
I told you I weren't holding no iron, boys.
Making sure. Take your shirt off him, Bob. Now, let him go, Bob. How come you ain't holding nothing, Sheriff?
Well, now you know what I'm gonna say, you believe.
Go on back here, Bob, where you was before.
All right.
Sheriff, you crazy?
Let me ask you a question, then you decide. How'd you like a full pardon for what you done in Missouri, Charlie? Robert, you need never go back into Kansas. You're free to stay here as long as you live. Come and go as you please. Don't have to worry about killing four people in Missouri. Besides, have $10,000. You've been robbing, you've been stealing, you've been killing. You got $10 between you? Both of you, murderers, thieves, scum. I figured you'd do that. I'm glad you did. Because now you're hating yourself.
Put your gun back, Bob. Let him run on a little bit more.
You like Jesse James, Charlie?
Ain't nothing about him I like or don't like.
You like Jesse, Robert?
Man's talking to you, Robert. Wants to know you like Jesse.
Do you?
Once Jesse and Bob had a little fight. 2 years ago, Bob was only 19 and Jesse a full-grown man. When Jesse was finished with Bob, Bob got to be a full-grown man.
The governor wants Jesse dead or alive.
A lot of people do.
Governor says he'd give both of you a full pardon and $10,000 for Jesse.
Ain't no bargain, Jesse being who he is. Gunfighter like he is, and fast like...
Whatever he'd do, it'd be a hero. People cheer.
That'd be nice.
What'd you say, Robert?
That'd be nice.
Ride with the governor.
That'd be nice.
Being a hero instead of a running dog.
I like that word.
Hero?
Yeah.
Robert?
Yeah?
Say it.
Hero.
What's the matter?
Listen to what I can say. $10,000.
Well, boys?
Jesse James died all of a sudden. Wouldn't take long for you to hear about it. We'd let you know.
That's a promise.
Chain reaction. Governor in bathtub, sheriff in waiting, Matty the girl card watcher, and the brothers Ford, Robert, and Charlie. The principals involved in getting Jesse James assassinated. It would be well at this point to remark upon some of the accomplishments of Jesse James. His standard feat was murdering cowboys and rustling cattle. One incident in Starr County, Texas, had him murdering single-handedly three cowboys and driving off 500 fine head of beef. A record which stands to this day. On record, too, is his slaying by bowie knife of Mr. John W. Wicker, a Pinkerton man from Chicago. Then there were several train robberies, outstanding of which was the one 5 miles east of Council Bluffs, where he and his men derailed the Chicago, Rock Island, and Pacific Express. The cars telescoped. The engineer was instantly killed. 12 passengers were seriously injured. And Jesse and his men robbed them all. There are many other mayhems too numerous to mention, except that they averaged 1.37 corpses per exploit. One act of kindness must be noted, however. Mr. Avery Thompson, hurt grievously by a runaway horse in the streets of Abilene, pleaded to be put out of his misery. From 50 paces, Jesse obliged. His act of mercy was applauded by all around. It was then this half-kind, half-renegade person that the brothers Ford were going to kill. Charlie and Robert went home, lit the kerosene lamp, and waited. They didn't have to wait too long.
Hi, Jesse. Come on in.
It was a Saturday night when Jesse walked through that doorway in Ray County, and Sunday was his favorite day because he could sleep late.
Listening to Crime Classics and your host, Thomas Highland. Tomorrow night, if you're in the mood for still more adventure listening, don't miss 21st Precinct, the program that probes the inner workings of the world's largest police force. 21st Precinct shows you policemen as the human beings they are, exposes their tough grinds, their dangerous careers. Remember, it's Tuesday nights on most of these same stations, presented by CBS Radio. And now, once again, Thomas Highland and the second act of Crime Classics, and his report to you on The Death of a Picture Hanger.
The night Jesse James walked into the Ford home, he was carrying a .45 Colt on one hip, .45 Smith Wesson on the other, and a .44 Derringer in his waistcoat, and a Winchester rifle hung limply from his left hand. Armed in this manner was standard operating procedure for Jesse when he walked into homes, a procedure which varied only some years before when he courted. At this time of romance, he did not wear the Derringer. It should be remarked, however, that the Winchester was kept by his feet like a faithful old dog. All of which adds up to the fact that all of the people who tried before this Saturday night to kill Jesse were long dead. And the Ford boys, Robert and Charlie, were well aware of this fact. But Robert wanted to be a hero, and Charlie wanted $10,000. So they were very hospitable.
Sit in the rocker, Jess. Want some whiskey? Bob. Heard you have been in Jefferson City, Jess.
Here you are, Jess. You must be sleepy, Jess.
What's the matter with you, Bob? You don't have to tell Jess when he's sleepy. Jess knows when he's sleepy.
I just don't want to talk important things to him, that's all. Not when his head's nodding.
Simmer down, Bob.
All right, Jess, I'll tell you. We're tired of lazing around. Me and Charlie been doing nothing, just waiting for you to say go. When you gonna say go, Jess?
Kid's anxious, Jess. Just like kids.
Tired, that's all.
Yeah. Been on my back like this for a week, Jess. Worrisome, ain't he?
Listen, Jess, we figured something.
A train, Jess.
Trains are easy.
You hear what he said? You hear what he said, Charlie? Trains are easy.
Kid.
The Chicago, Rock Island, and Pacific out of Kansas City. It makes a stop at Winston, Jess.
At Cameron, too.
Here's your drink, Jess. We're going to do it to the train, Jess? Yahoo!
Need some sleep. Bob, fix Jess that place in the barn.
Sure. Sure, Will.
So Bob went out to the barn, fluffed up some straw, and made a bed for Jesse to sleep in. This was considered an act of compassion of the time, barn owners to wayfarers. But in this instance, it was known as a tactic. Get Jesse on his back in the barn with maybe his guns off. Get him while he's sleeping. So consider now what we have here. Jesse James bedded down for the night and his two would-be assassins as guardian angels. In the trade, this is known as a precarious position. So switch now from prone Jesse to outside the barn. Nearly midnight in Missouri, and a mist from the river threading between Charlie Ford and Bob.
When are we going to kill Jess?
Try killing him from now on.
You think he's sleeping?
Where'd you bed him down?
Under that window.
Let's go peek, see if he's sleeping.
What you think?
He's lying there, all right.
Eyes closed?
Can't tell. Sure tell this, though.
What?
Look at that pool of moon. Wait a minute, I'll get out of your way. See?
He's holding a gun in each hand.
He's a light sleeper.
When he sleeps.
We don't even know he's sleeping.
Charlie.
Hmm?
Shoot him. Kill him.
You want to be the hero, younger brother. You do.
Supposing I miss?
I'll shoot you just where you're standing if you miss. Because if you miss, you wake Jess. And I'll just explain to Jess that I killed you to save his life. That way, saving mine.
If we were sure he's sleeping, be no trouble at all.
You make sure.
If some kind of animal or something walked by him soft, that'd be a way. Hey, you wait here a minute. Come here, you little old dog. That's right. You too old to live anyhow. Little dog's too old to live anyhow, Charlie. Step aside a minute. I'll push him through this chink in the wall. Critter'd run into the barn past Jess, and we'll find out for sure.
You're chattering like a woman, Bob. Just do it.
Bob and Charlie huddled together that night, and in the morning they flashed their nicest, sleepiest grins when they awoke to find Jesse James standing over them.
I shot me this critter last night. Who's gonna cook me my breakfast?
The boys tumbled out of bed and vied who would be first at the skillet. Bob won, and Charlie put the kettle on. It was late, and it was Sunday, so they had brunch. Toward its end, as a gesture of carefree camaraderie, Jesse heaved the Ford's best china against the wall.
Breaking them against the wall's easy, Jess. Why don't you throw them up in the air and shoot them?
You crazy, Bob. What'd you tell him to do that for?
Use up all his bullets and then we... Hey, watch it, Jess!
Ain't gonna hit you, Bob. Just seeing how close I can come.
In the name of heaven,
now,
Jess!
Cut it out, Jesse. You got the kid almost crying.
Stand still. See how you like it, Charlie. See if I can fan your ear without drawing blood. Now let's go do it to a train.
Which meant riding down to Winston, which meant for the Ford boys a constant vigilance for the moment when Jesse would turn his back, would ride ahead of them a few paces, anything so that they could have an irretrievable advantage. Historians make category of this event as the ride to Winston with the Fords up front. Jesse just didn't trust anybody to ride in back of him, except his mom, but then she was only comfortable on very slow horses. So down to Winston they rode, and at 9:30 p.m. on Monday night, they boarded the Chicago, Rock Island, and Pacific train. As soon as the train started, they dressed themselves in white linen dusters. They wore red handkerchiefs over their faces, and they waited in the vestibule for the conductor. 15 minutes later, Jesse James and the Fords left behind them two corpses, a wounded engineer, and an empty duck cage, the boys having released a dozen ducks from the express car. They took with them $8,000 in cash and convertible mementos. The boys jumped off the train at a point where they had tethered their horses. Then they rode south. They rode to St. Joseph, Missouri. They rode to the home of Jesse James, with Jesse riding behind.
Wait out here, boys. Annie.
That you, Jess?
Sure.
I'm in the kitchen. Oh, hello, Jess.
Don't you kiss me now, Ann. You wait till I wash off this road dust.
I don't mind.
You're too pretty to get mussed up.
Oh, Jess.
What you got there, Ann?
I was in Isaac's today to see about some harness. He gave me this calendar. He said, you put this up in a nice place, Mrs. Howard.
Everybody in town calls you Mrs. Howard, don't they, Ann?
They call us the Happy Howards. They ask what you do, I say a traveling man. You been traveling, Jess?
I brought you a watch, Mrs. Howard. Here.
Why, Mr. Howard, porcelain and gold, just what I wanted. Now you go away and wash so I can kiss you. What you doing to that calendar, Jess?
Pretty picture of a horse, Ann. Tear off the calendar part, it'll look nice in the parlor. Nail it up in the parlor, Ann.
Some tacks and a hammer in the cabinet.
Brought the Ford boys with me, Ann.
Oh, that's nice. Mm-hmm.
I'll have the boys come in. You make us something to eat.
I'll fetch you some water first for washing.
Come on in, boys. You boys like this picture?
Right good picture of a horse.
What are you going to do with it, Jess?
Figure to hang it here somewheres.
I wouldn't want me a picture of no horse in the parlor.
You just ain't got no eye.
No, he ain't. Yeah, I think hanging a picture like that's real good. Where are you going to hang it, Jess?
Here, I guess.
Ah, that's too low to hang a picture.
Yeah.
Higher, huh?
I had me that picture, and I was going to hang it. I'd hang it higher.
Maybe you're right. Pleasant to be home.
How's your missus?
Pleasant to be home. Man don't have to carry around all these guns weighing heavy around his middle. Feels mighty fine.
I said, how's your missus, Jess?
Getting water. Gonna cook us something. Get off that chair, Bob.
What for?
You stupid. I said I was gonna hang me this picture.
All right.
Pretty picture. Bob.
All right. All right, Charlie!
You shot the back of Jesse's head off, Bob.
That make me a hero, don't it?
Sure does.
Shooting Mr. Howard, alias Jesse James, in the back was a very heroic deed. So heroic that a song was written about it. The refrain goes, "And the dirty little coward, he shot Mr. Howard and laid Jesse James in his grave."
In just a moment, Thomas Highland will tell you about next week's crime classic. The Death of a Picture Hanger, tonight's crime classic, was adapted from the original court reports and newspaper accounts by Morton Fine and David Friedkin. The music was composed and conducted by Bernard Herrmann, and the program is transcribed and directed by Elliot Lewis. Thomas Highland is portrayed on radio by Lou Merrill. In tonight's story, Clayton Post was heard as Jess, Paul Fries as Charlie, and Sam Edwards as Bob. Featured in the cast were Joseph Kearns, Charlotte Lawrence, Paula Winslow, and Joseph Granby. Roy Rowan speaking. Now here again is Thomas Highland.
Next week, a bedroom in Baltimore, Maryland, in June 1871. Its occupant, William Scott Ketchum, Major General, United States Army, retired. My report to you will be on the final day of General Ketchum and how he died. Thank you. Good night.
Later this evening, Herbert Marshall has the leading role in a story adapted from Daphne du Maurier's collection called Kiss Me Again, Stranger. It's the eerie story of the birds, describing strange happenings on an otherwise quiet English countryside. Hear it later this evening on most of these same stations when CBS Radio presents The Summer Theater. Yes, later this evening, starring Herbert Marshall. Stay tuned now for Gary Moore with Arthur Godfrey's Talent Scouts, which follows immediately over most of these same stations. And remember, for mystery mixed with merriment, join Mr. and Mrs. North Tuesday nights on the CBS Radio Network.
That was Death of a Picture Hanger from Crime Classics here on the Mysterious Old Radio Listening Society podcast. Once again, I'm Eric.
I'm Tim.
And I'm Joshua.
That was Joshua's pick this week, the old Crime Classics. I say that like I'd ever even heard of it before. I had not even heard
of
this.
Well, we listened to and discussed another
Have
episode
we?
Of this.
Which
Have
one we? Did we?
What
did
yeah. Oh, we did.
What was it? Was it War of the Worlds?
Bummy Bungler's
Bunny Bumler.
Boudoir.
Yes, it was the bun guy. Bunny Bunmuller's
we're not making this up.
You are making this
no,
up.
We'll have our intern Oliver look this up.
Bunny.
Send you an email.
Okay, well, I forgot, and so did you. So
this German baker, if I remember correctly.
Oh, I kind of remember this now. But when you pick something, Joshua, I always assume, oh, I'm a big fan of this, and I've listened to a lot of these. Is that true of Crime Classics?
Yes. The episode we can't remember the name of is what sent me to Crime Classics, and I've listened to, I would say, about 3/4 of them.
Wow.
Over the last couple of years. My curiosity was piqued by that episode.
It's so piqued that it's really on the forefront of our brains.
It was a deliberately sort of tongue twister-esque title.
Oh.
I'm going to stick with that.
Okay. Bunny Baumgartner, Bear of Belgrade.
Baker of Buns.
I'm sure people tune into this podcast to hear middle-aged men try to remember stuff, but
okay,
perhaps we should
we could change
forward.
The name of the...
Since we're talking about it, let's let the listeners know a little peek behind the curtain. We just had a conversation, the three of us, realizing that we were all in a show that we had forgotten that we were all in the show together. Wait, were you in that show? No
I
way.
Knew.
You were in that show?
I directed that show.
Tim directed the show. Tim, do you remember casting me? No.
We rehearsed in this basement.
That's right. We did. I forgot that, too.
Oh, I forgot to include that in the biography of Tim that I wrote.
Okay.
Hey, so this episode.
Yeah. Who wants to go first?
Well,
you
I
go
will,
first.
I
it's
will
yours.
Tell you why I chose this to some degree. And you know me, and particularly after last week's episode, there's some tonal similarities between the two episodes, even though the genre is vastly different. But I really like these unconventional approaches to storytelling when they work. And I think Crime Classics certainly qualifies as unconventional. I think the best way to describe why I like this is through a movie quote, and it is a movie quote that my wife, Adrian, uses all the time to describe a very specific type of art or entertainment. And that quote is from the 1985 classic Real Genius. And that is "Smart People on Ice." And I think that is a very apt description of this show, or more specifically, the talents behind this show. It is frivolity by choice, expertly done.
What does smart people on ice mean? Like, they're bad at hockey?
Now I have a new quote.
Seriously, what does that mean, smart people on ice?
Well, I'll explain the scene from Real Genius. No, I won't. This is not the middle-aged men explain movie scenes from the 1980s podcast.
If anyone out there has that podcast, let us know. I'd love to listen to that.
And then forget guests. About it. Forget I ever heard it.
What I mean by that is they could probably write this really gritty, utterly suspenseful crime tale. This is Elliot mm-hmm. Lewis. This is mm-hmm. Morton and Friedkin. But they would rather have fun.
Okay, so here's my take on this episode in general. I'll just give you my qualms with it. One, it has a very Dragnet feel to it. That's not a qualm. That I love Dragnet.
It's the same era.
It's the pace, right? The pace is slow. Here's what bothers me. I can't wait to see your reaction, because I know you're going to tell me. No,
well,
that's
I in no way expected you to enjoy this episode. That's why I brought it.
You're going to convince me when I'm done that I looked at this wrong. Here's what bothers me. You come up at the top and you say, here's Jesse James.
Can I just predict it? Okay. This is a story about Jesse James. There could be horses. There could be gunfire.
No.
There could be car crashes.
No. None of that was what I was about to say. But now that you've gone there, where are the horses and the gunfire? No.
Get a picture.
Right. There's a picture of a horse and one dumb shot. No, it was this. You come out at the top and you say, hey, here's Jesse James getting shot in the back of the head while hanging a picture of a horse, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now all we're doing is waiting for that. And hear me out. Small rewrite that I think makes this a whole lot better, just in case I don't know or remember how the Jesse James thing ended, I would at the end go, oh, I didn't know that. Jesse James got shot in the head while hanging a picture of a horse. Instead, by telling me that at the top, I'm just waiting for him to get shot in the back of the head while hanging a picture from a horse for half an hour. See what I'm getting at?
Mm-hmm.
You take that thing out at the top, that tease, and we've talked about this before, how you can ruin a good radio show with the tease. There's a number of shows we've had that complain about. And this one exemplifies that for me. That was unnecessary.
I can't believe how much I disagree with both of you.
Nice. Go.
This was gorgeous. I loved this.
And I love it too.
But not even in a frivolous way. I think this is a really well-constructed piece of art.
I think we maybe misunderstand our definitions of
fair
smart
enough,
people
of smart
on
people
ice.
On ice, sure.
Yes. We're going to have to do that podcast later.
It's about dumb hockey players, Tim.
But like here's my experience with this episode. It starts out with this picture of this horse.
Mm-hmm.
And then the frame of that picture kind of gets bigger. Mm-hmm. And you see a picture of Jesse James getting shot in the back of the head by a friend and a horse.
Mm-hmm.
Not that he was shot by a horse.
That would have been cool, too.
And then the rest of the episode is just explaining the meaning of that picture.
Yeah.
And it's the narrative really is just the characters. It's discovering who these characters are who shoot him. And the story, air quotes that you can't see, is Jesse James gets shot in the back of the head. But learning the character arc of I want to be a hero and he's remembered as a coward, it was just really beautifully, poetically put together for me. I really, really liked it.
And for me, I hear what Eric's saying. And to connect it back to Smart People on Ice, I'm going to dial that in a little harder and say these are people who are looking for ways to innovate storytelling for no other reason than to innovate storytelling. And I think it's the kind of thing where this series asks the question, what if we told these stories by just starting at the end? That would be challenging. How would we do that? And I think where it succeeds for me, and I think it's very similar to what you're saying, is that there are these unexpected changes in both tone and perspective and who is even the protagonist of this story that make it really, to me, exciting from scene to scene. And that makes up for the fact that I know how it's going to end. And I know the final beat of the story, but that I don't think is the story. if that makes sense.
It does.
Because it's him saying it is the characters. And at one point, the narrator says the story is this strange series of events that lead to that event. You know, from a governor's bathtub to a card watcher in a saloon to the Ford brothers to the just funny and sad final beats of Jesse James' life were suddenly, after spending 10 minutes of a man who never lets his guard down,
shot a dog in the middle of the night,
gets home and the gun belt comes off and how you doing, honey, and he talks to the Ford brothers like he's talking to his kids. Get off that chair, I'm hanging a picture. And totally has this sense that he is safe at home, this sense that we all have. And so in those final moments, I felt this, despite all the crimes we had listed that he performed, I felt this affinity for him in that moment, because we all, like, we're at peace at home.
Little empathy.
Yeah. And then he's shot in the back of the head.
Well, and being shot in the back of the head is not the final beat. The final beat is the guy who shot him is remembered as a coward.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I told you when I stated my opinion that I can't wait to see how fast you would change it. And you did.
But it's a legitimate opinion. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying you're an idiot, Eric, because I'm sure there are a lot of people listening to this who agree with you. Like, they would rather be surprised by an ending.
Don't get me wrong. It's not you I'm talking. I'm talking to Tim changed my mind.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Well, and this is a type of storytelling that I really, really enjoy personally.
Yeah.
This sort of still life short story style.
Yeah. Do you guys agree and hear that Dragnet type style to it that I was talking about?
Oh, yeah. Dragnet also has some of that. The actual plot has some twists, but most of it is just spending time with these characters and getting to know their weirdness.
Yeah, exactly. And it's got that same kind of pace to it.
One of the things I love about crime classics, and they do this with every single episode.
Does a governor take a bath in detail in every episode of crime classics?
Every episode. This one, they're kind of skimpy on the details, actually.
It was the, hey, I'm done with this bath. You want to spend some time in mayor soup? That was...
You were saying before I interrupted with my X-rated...
It's okay, because now I can't decide if I want to say what I was going to say or talk more about the bathtub scene, because I have so much to say on both topics. Well, we'll start with the first thing. The first thing is that every episode of Crime Classics starts, and I think it's a brilliant way for an audio to start, and I'm surprised it took till 1950-whatever for someone to do it, is Hyland just saying, listen. And then there's some narratively significant piece of sound effect. And then it always, to some degree or other, sometimes it's not the final beat of the story. Sometimes it's maybe at a different point in the story, but it is a flash forward involving that sound effect, which they backtrack to get to that moment that is presented via sound effect.
Yep.
The other thing I enjoyed is that they kept Jesse James out of the title, because when I listened to it, that was just a glorious extra surprise to find out the picture hanger is Jesse James.
And to give him that title over anything else.
Yeah. Back to the bathtub.
Yes, please. Back to the bathtub.
One of the things I love is that they take scenes that other radio shows, not all, but many radio shows might just have a scene in the governor's office. Mm-hmm. And it's full of significant exposition. It starts all the dominoes falling for the story, but they're like, let's make it interesting. Let's make it the sheriff standing there awkwardly watching the governor take a bath. And also, they always think about scenes for the sound effects, too. And I think that's what reminds me of Dragnet, is the sound effects are really clean.
Yes, exactly.
And really specific. So the sloshing in the bathtub, even down to when he asks for what, like the rose water
oil,
and glycerin.
Yeah.
And then he's patting himself.
Yes.
These that's fleshy really, pat sounds.
Yeah, visceral.
So you get the idea that he's not being at all...
discreet.
No, not at all. He's just like... slapping rose wire over his, the governorship. And
anybody else picture Harvey Korman in Blazing Saddles?
All the time.
Tim beat me to the joke.
There's a bathtub scene in Blazing Saddles.
Headley.
Here's a question. For a while, I thought that the convention of this story and how they were going to tell it was that we were never going to hear Jesse James' voice.
I thought that as well.
I was compelled by that and a little disappointed when he did talk. And then I kept asking myself, well, why did you wait that long? So tell me, why wait that long to set up like we're never going to hear this dude talk? And that's the thing. And then he comes in.
It's not that long. And I think it builds up the suspense. It ratchets up the suspense. You always talk about this scene in Inglourious Basterds that you like so much.
And a couple of scenes that are tension-filled.
This scene reminded me of that because he doesn't talk. And instead of talking, they sit him in a rocking chair. Another great use of audio. And you just hear the light squeak of the rocking chair. And A, great audio image. B, imagining Jesse James just sitting in a rocking chair like a grandma. And it leaves the Ford brothers to just fall all over themselves nervously trying to fill in where Jesse James should be talking. And by the time Jesse James does speak, you're as frightened as the Ford brothers are. That's how I read it.
Yeah. So it creates the
tension
by not hearing him for a while. All right, great. Thanks for explaining everything to me. This thing's a classic. Best show ever.
But will we remember the title a year from now?
No. Bungalow Bob, the picture hanger.
I have to say I particularly enjoy Paul Frees as
the
Charlie
parrot?
Ford.
Oh, geez.
Yes, and the parrot. Particularly the scene where the Ford brothers are peeking through the barn window.
Yes.
Frees is so quiet.
Yeah.
Like, I had to crank up the volume, and I hadn't heard. I'm used to, in old-time radio, they
like
basically
stage
use
whisper,
stage whispers.
Mm-hmm.
But that was just so quiet. Again, for something that I think at times is so funny, when they turn on the tension, it's really high in this.
Mm-hmm.
And as you pointed out, Eric, they managed to achieve a tension in a story that they've told you the outcome of. And you're tense in these scenes where you go, oh, wait, we know Jesse James lives long enough to hang a picture. Why are we so tense? Well, we don't know if he kills the Ford brothers. If you don't know a lot about Wild West history, you don't.
But the scene of him sleeping with guns in hand and shoots a dog. It's really bad. Shot a dog.
And he's like, I shot this last night. Who's making breakfast?
Once killed a man for snoring too loud. That's a
read all about it.
That's a joke for people of a certain age.
Yeah, I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. That's not a joke. That's just something Johnny Cash said.
Right.
Yay!
I almost bought that Time Life collection because of that line. The idea then I am shifting on here is I'm starting to see your point of view on this.
I know it is not to your personal taste of, you know, thrilling adventure kind of stuff, and it almost promises to be, which I can understand why it becomes disappointing.
I got disappointed with, I'm waiting to hear what they've told me is going to happen. But from your perspective, that's not what this story is about. It's not about Jesse James getting killed. It's about these dudes who were assigned,
get rich and famous for killing him.
Right.
Yeah.
Because they told me that at the top, I was just listening to the story of Jesse James. Instead of what the story was supposed to be. And now listening to you, I wish I would have had that perspective because I would have enjoyed it more.
Well, the great thing is, because you know how it ends, you can still go back and pick up all of these great things. There's
the bath. Just go back for the bath.
Oh, I listened to that bath scene about 9 times.
I love the way Bob, and it's such a critical moment because of the conclusion of the story when Robert Ford just quietly and so wistfully says, I want to be a hero.
Yeah.
It's very sad. He's abused
he's the
by
runt of the litter.
Brother. Yeah. Yeah. And he's already been beaten up by Jesse James, and his brother claims it made him a man. But in that moment, you realize, no.
It made him beat up.
It did not.
It was the mayor bath that made him a man.
Governor bath. It's more impressive.
Oh, yes. Right. That's a good point. Bigger.
Weird detail. Well, I don't want to dwell on the bath, but...
But... Hop on in.
All that talk to the sheriff about when you're governor, I'm setting you up here. You're going to live like this with these four bronze cherubs or golden cherubs, whatever they're holding me up.
I love when he says, when's the last time you had a bath? And the sheriff goes, Kansas City, just after the hanging of Billy Bob Williams. And I just love that idea of that you use public executions as a mnemonic device to remember your grooming schedule.
Right.
Weird detail that just stuck with me, you know, 200, how many ever episodes he listened to, that most details are gone right now, but then he went home and put on an alpaca coat. That sounds warm.
Too warm.
Very detailed, this episode, which I like. A lot of it comes from the narration. Some of it comes from all the little details.
The subtle gesture of the card counter holding up three fingers, was it? And her tongue sticking out to the left.
Yep.
And that's what's fun about it is you just never know how you're going to enter a scene or what's going to go on in it. And just because it might start with a comic description like that, it could then turn into a really suspenseful scene for all you know. So it keeps me on the edge of my seat for that reason. One last bathtub line that I love is when the narrator says, "Sheriff Timberlake was a man who instinctively knew his way around a bathtub." And when he sums up Jesse James' crimes as 1.37 corpses per exploit. And it's just that cavalier attitude of the narrator that is so fun.
Well, if no one's got anything else, why don't we throw this thing to a vote? Let me tell you guys what you're going to say. Tim, do you think it's a high art and a classic?
Yeah.
It's in the title. Crime classics. Right. Now we know how to get that vote from us.
Totally acknowledge that it is, buttering my personal aesthetic taste up personally to get that classic out of me. But it works. Buttered up my classic.
You got butter on my classic.
I need to take a bath.
Oh, yeah. I think this is a classic in my estimation. I think the series in this episode in particular really demonstrates how, in spite of, or maybe more accurately, because of the increased pressure from television, that radio in the 1950s, for a while, until it was very clear they were going to lose the contest, just kept trying to innovate and find new and interesting ways to tell stories, till the very bitter end, which might have been like 57, 58. I don't know if we can pinpoint that moment, but this is still where I think radio is just really trying to impress listeners and bring them back to the format.
I won't call it a classic, but my opinion certainly has changed dramatically from this discussion, which is how the whole world should operate. Aww. We should all just listen to each other and then maybe...
You're wrong, maybe... Eric.
That glimmer of hope's now gone. I like it a lot better listening to you guys. I will say, stands the test of time, and I liked it.
Awesome.
I did want to quickly say that I was struck by how much this stands the test of time in that in this era of true crime podcasts, you could just take these episodes and re-record them and package them as true crime podcasts of today, and the mix of
public domain music behind
this. Yeah, and the mix of irony and suspense and wit
would be
really popular.
Two things. One, why are you telling everybody that? And two, why don't we do that?
This is the last episode of the Mysterious Old Radio Listening Society, everyone.
Tune into our true crime podcast.
Crime Neoclassics.
Yes, there we got it.
What is
it? Boom, Crime Neoclassics.
It was Bunny Baumler, his close brush with fame.
Yes, it was.
Wasn't that the tart story? No, that was a different
thing. Story. Okay. Yeah, the... Man Who Loved Cream Tarts.
Yeah, I hated that one too.
But they're both pastry related.
Yes,
thank
you.
Not a fan of pastry related old time radio, apparently.
You put pastry in a story, I am out. Tim, tell them stuff.
Please go visit ghoulishtlights.com. You can look up old episodes we've done. Like I just did.
Like
Bunny Baumler, his close brush with fame. You can also send us messages. You can request episodes you'd like us to listen to. If you have a favorite crime classics episode, let us know. Demand we listen to it. We will get there eventually. You can comment on episodes. You can vote in polls. You can link to our Threadless store and buy some mysterious old swag. And you can also link to our Patreon page.
Yes, you can go to patreon.com/themorals and support this podcast. But don't take it from me, folks. Take it from one of our valued podcast supporters.
Hi, my name is James Nordstrom, and I'm here to do a little bit of a testimonial as to Why, I'm a patron for the Mysterious Old Radio Listening Society podcast. Why am I a patron? Basically, I'm a patron because I believe that artists should get paid for their work. And I really do enjoy their work a lot, so I don't have a problem giving them some awesome money. Also, they use the money to really work hard to create community. I have my my little card. I've got my little little button there, which I think is a really cool, special way to make all the members feel welcome. Also, they really do an effective job of using technology to really build community with their book club and the happy hours. They've really leveraged that very effectively, and I really enjoy it. So come on down and join the Morals. Thanks and bye.
And if you want to see us perform live, doing recreations and adaptations of classic radio drama, or in large part, our own original work live on stage, come see the Mysterious Old Radio Listening Society perform monthly. To find out where we're performing every month, just go to ghoulishdelights.com or mysteriousoldradiolisteningsociety.com, and either one of those will give you the information and how to buy tickets and where we're performing and what we're performing that particular month. You can also watch us live, streamed thing on the internet thing, and get a ticket that way, or you can watch it later and get a ticket that way as well. Don't even have to be available that night. So you are out of excuses. We will see you at our shows. Hey, everybody, what's coming up next?
Next, we have a listener request, and it is The Big Cast from Dragnet. Until then,
look out!
Time Life Books got on a trail of the Old West. Good thing, too. They rescued a photograph you didn't know existed. Put it all down while you could still get the straight story about people.
Like these two sons of a Baptist minister. They staged the first daylight bank robbery in U.S. history. Frank and Jesse James. Here's Clay Allison. Called himself a shootist. Hair trigger Pat Masterson, who wound up a New York sports writer. And what kind of lady was wanted for horse stealing and bootlegging? That was no lady. That was Belle Starr. John Wesley Harden. Before the Texas Rangers caught up with him, he shot 44 men, one of them just for snoring too loud.
I almost bought that Time Life collection because of that line.